Hello, Joan Tower. Thank you for coming into the light.
Thank you for inviting me.
We are about to play some music of yours, and I've told our listeners a little bit about the piece, but I wonder if you have any stories you'd like to tell. And I'm thinking about Sequoia. It's a wonderful piece, which I adore. Is there anything that you can tell us about how you started to think about it? Or?
Well, that's a very interesting question and a good one, because Sequoia actually changed my life.
Really?
Yeah. It was my first orchestra piece, and it was commissioned by the American Composers Orchestra. Mm-hmm. And Francis Thorne, who is this, he used to be the executive director of the orchestra and is the prime mover behind that extraordinary orchestra, which is a orchestra that does all new music only. And I think it's only one of two orchestras in the country that devotes itself to new music. They play at Carnegie Hall. It's a fantastic organization. Anyways, he came along and he said, Joan, it's time for you to write an orchestra piece. And I was like, no. I was like already in my late 30s. Nowadays, you know, you come into a competition with three orchestra pieces at the age of 18 or whatever.
Is it because you weren't interested in doing it, or you were intimidated by the
idea? No, I was intimidated. Mm-hmm. I was totally intimidated, because I had been around chamber music all my life, and the idea of an orchestra just scared me. So he persisted, and he said, this is now time for you to do this piece. So I said, okay. So I started to write this piece, and it was just sheer torture. Well, like most of my pieces are sheer torture, but this one was even particularly torturous because it was for orchestra. And so then the rehearsals were in New York, and they were held at the studio. I forgot the name of the studio, Carroll Studio on 42nd Street, and it was like this low-level room. And they had to rehearse there because that was where all the percussion was. And I had 64 percussion instruments in this piece.
64?
Yes, 5 percussionists, very active. I love percussion. So it was in this low-ceiling room, and they were all jammed together. And I found myself sitting next to the cowbell. And all I could hear was cowbells. That's all I could hear.
Were you at – this was the first rehearsal?
Their first rehearsal, and I was a wreck. You know, because it's sort of like you're an architect with a blueprint, which is an architectural blueprint. It's very, very finite. And your building is going up in 15 minutes. And there you're looking at this thing that you spent a year on, and the windows are too big, and the colors are all wrong. You know, it's very anxiety-provoking, especially with an orchestra. So I'm sitting there hearing the cowbell. That's all I can hear. And Dennis Russell Davies was conducting, and he would turn to me and ask me questions. And I was like practically trembling that I couldn't answer the questions and I couldn't hear. And he said, Joan, you're sitting in the wrong place. Come over here. Sit over here next to the flutes. So at that point, all I could hear was piccolos. But actually, that turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because I was like I had a good excuse. I couldn't hear anything, see?
Yeah.
So I could answer questions like, is this an A flat or is this an A natural or whatever? You want a slur here, that kind of thing. But I had an excuse that I couldn't hear the whole orchestra, so it was less intimidating as time wore on. Then they moved into Alice Tully Hall, this beautiful hall at Lincoln Center with great acoustics. Yeah. And all of a sudden, this piece, which they had rehearsed now for three times, I think it was, which they could now play, came alive in full regalia.
That must have been a thrill.
And I was sitting there just about, I mean, it was just like you had a skyscraper that you had just created. There was the skyscraper. You had created it. Like, you're looking at this monumental thing that you designed and created. I mean, that's the feeling,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And I was just overwhelmed. And I kept following Dennis Davies around like a puppy dog, because I was so needy and my anxiety level was so high. And he kept sort of like trying to get away from me. Like, Joan, get lost. You know, get lost. I said, well, is there anything you want to ask me or tell me or anything? No. We're just doing fine. In fact, we're going to change the program around so your piece is featured.
Ooh.
I was like, really? Wow, fantastic. So that gave me the one clue that he thought the piece had potential. Because I thought it was a total disaster, of course. Because of my anxiety.
Where does the featured piece go?
It goes right before intermission.
Right before intermission, yeah.
But they invited Keith Jarrett to play a concerto by Alan Hovhaness, and they put him right before me. Mm. And the place was sold out, not because of anybody except Keith Jarrett.
Right.
And he was right before my piece. I thought, I'm dead. I'm dead in the water in here. And I was sitting in a box, and I was just convinced that the whole thing was going to be a disaster. So intermission comes, and there's this line of people waiting to congratulate me on my piece. And I said to myself, "In, you know, these are all my friends. They just want to, you know, give me some encouragement, sympathize with me, hold my hand while I'm, you know." But actually, they actually liked the piece. But, of course, I didn't see that because, again, you know, I was just totally into this world of this is a disaster.
Well, it's a piece to like.
Then what happened was Dennis decided to program in San Francisco. Then Zubin Mehta got a hold of it and decided to program it with New York, which is another whole story. And then he reprogrammed it at the United Nations. On United Nations Day, which was televised. Then Leonard came in and heard the piece, slacked him. And he said, I am going to play this piece in X, X, Y, and Z, like four different orchestras around the country. And I want to put a hold on the recording. I want to record this piece with St. Louis. And furthermore, I want you to be composer in residence with St. Louis.
Whoa.
I was just nonplussed. This piece literally changed my life.
That is wonderful.
That's the story of Sequoia. So you that was a great question.
All right, before you get all worn out.
No, I'm fine. Fine. I'm cooking.
Let me ask you a general question.
Okay.
What do you think makes a good piece of music? If you're listening to a student's piece, let's say, or a colleague, is there something you do want the music to do?
Oh, yeah, definitely. That's a complex question, which I'll try to answer simply or just try to answer. The first thing I look for in a piece of music is continuity. That the piece goes from place to place in a way that is natural and makes sense and is coherent and motivated. That's the first thing. The second thing I look for is a voice, which is more elusive. But
a composer's personal voice.
Yeah. Most composers, experienced composers, will know what a voice means because as composers, we're surrounded by so many styles and we're influenced so easily by so many composers. It takes a while to get through those composers and all that music, whatever music it is that you love, and come out on the other side with something that is your own. So those are the two things I look for. Even with beginners, and I get beginners sometimes, beginner students.
But within those parameters, there could be any style. It's not a particular style.
No,
or particular
it has nothing
technique.
To do with style.
It has to do with those qualities.
It has nothing to do with style, actually.
There's one question that people ask me and that I hate, so you don't have to answer this. But just in case people say, and it's a perfectly reasonable question, but it, for some reason, always stumps me. What kind of music do you write?
Oh, yeah, that stumps me too. I don't like that. It's sort of like it's the same question as, you know, it's a stylistic question.
Yeah.
I was called a New Age neoclassic composer Totally wrong. First of all, I'm not New Age because I've got too much energy in my music.
Oh, gosh. That's for sure.
Yeah. So.
Well, let me pick another piece. Would you mind talking about In Memory? Because it's something I'm going to want to play.
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. First of all, I'd like to say that writing for string quartet is just a wonderful adventure. I've written 3 of them now, and I have traveled around the string quartet a lot, the string quartet world a lot, because of these 3 quartets. And I think it's probably one of the best worlds I've ever been in, because as a composer, I go into worlds as a litmus test, living composer. I come in, and all of a sudden, I'm a litmus test for that culture, whatever that culture that is, whether it's the organ world or this orchestra world, the percussion world, the guitar world. Every one of these worlds has a culture. And coming in as a living composer, I am a litmus test for that culture, which is I've developed over the years. The string quartet world is fascinating. And it passes that litmus test in spades because there are 4 composers sitting there making decisions about music. So they have to be very creative and very compositional in their reactions to all the music they play.
Whether it's Beethoven or
whether it's Beethoven or me. Right. So making something better, making it work, is no news to them. I mean, it's just what they do. They do that all the time. But because there's so many string quartets and it's a very competitive world, and because the literature is so strong, they're sort of at a higher level with it than most chamber groups. I say that reluctantly because I'm thinking of trios and I'm thinking of wind quintets. All these players struggle to do the best they can, but the string quartet world is particularly competitive, and therefore the standard is very high.
And the standard of the music is so high, too.
Exactly. So you come into this world, and oh my God, you're up against one of the problems. You come into the guitar world, you're coming into a certain literature. You come into the string quartet world, you're coming into another literature. This is a little funny story. I wrote this piece for a trombone and string quartet called Elegy, and I heard it played and I didn't like it at all, the piece. And then I said, well, you know, maybe you're being too severe. Why don't you get another trombonist? So I got 2 other trombonists with 2 very good trombonists. Alan Trudell from Canada and Becky Bauer, who's plays in the Pittsburgh Symphony, they played it, and it was still a problem. The piece was still a problem. So I said, okay, this piece is going on the shelf. One of 2 pieces I've ever put on a shelf. This piece is not going to have a life. So about 3 years later, the phone rings, and there's this Israeli trombonist on the other end. I'm so honored to talk to you. I think you're just a wonderful, wonderful composer, and I am playing your Elegy. I said, what? Where did you get it?
Where did you get it?
Silence. Oh, I got it from a friend of a friend. I said, you know, I have shelved that piece, and there was more silence. He said, no. That is impossible. You know, that is taught. No. You must never shelve that piece. It's a masterpiece. And I said, have you played other pieces in this genre? Trombone and string quartets? Oh, I've played them all. Hmm. I know all of them. How many are there? 5. And yours is the best. So I said, okay, I guess I'm batting well, 1 out of 5, you know. But anyways, he came up and we fixed it. He was so devoted to this piece. And I said, I got to help him. So he brought a string quartet up, and we painted, repainted the bees and saved it.
How do you mean repainted?
Well, I had a live ensemble and a live trombone, and I just said, okay, try this, do this, do, like dancers do.
Yeah.
It's a luxury that musicians don't have usually because we have notation,
right,
which gets in the way of everything.
Did you change structure, notes,
rhythms? I changed registers. I changed notes. I took out a passage. I added a passage. I did some major reconstruction with it, and I saved it.
And did your Israeli trombonist like it even better after that?
Yes.
That's good.
He did. But the string quartet world is just a very unusual world. And my first quartet was written for the Muir Quartet, which is called Night Fields. The second one was written for the Tokyo Quartet. And the third one, called Incandescent, was written for the Emerson Quartet. And I walked into this world like I would walk into any world. Okay, what's going on here? And how do you guys and women, there's a lot of women in the string quartets now, how do you deal with composers above ground? It's my question. It's always my question. And I get different answers.
Above ground.
You know, a WAGs, we call them. Women, American women above ground. We have European, or EWAGs, European women above ground. So the second string quartet was written for the Tokyo, and they loved it. To make a long story short, we co-created this piece together. They edited it with me. I checked with them on my changes, and when they said, yes, that's great, I'd go with it. When they said, well, I would think about it. This is a real co-editing job that we did together because I respect their level of instinct very highly. And they fell in love with the piece and played it all over the world. And then they came back and recorded it, and that's the recording you're going to hear, which is on Naxos.
Tell me about the third quartet for the Emerson.
Okay, then Emerson comes along, another distinguished quartet, and I'm feeling the pressure of this because I am very aware now of what groups are up against. They have to have a strong piece that they like and that their audiences like. Otherwise, they won't keep playing it. So the pressure of that is something I'm very aware of.
And they commissioned this piece?
Yes. And they premiered it at Bard, actually, where the opening of a new hall that we had that Gary designed, a beautiful hall.
Now, did they give you any, or does anyone, for that matter, give you any parameters when they commission a piece, or did they just say, write us a piece?
Well, they usually have a time limit. Mm-hmm. They usually say, we want a short piece from 5 to 7 minutes, or we want a longer piece, 20, 25 minutes. Mm-hmm. That's about it.
Yeah.
There's no other
because
restriction.
They,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. This piece, Incandescent, they also fell in love with and took all over the world. Now, to have that happen to a composer twice is quite a miracle because these are players that play all over the world on a regular basis.
Well, I'm sure they know what they're playing.
Yeah, it's not like an orchestra that plays a piece once or twice and then it goes into the shelf, onto the shelf. Or maybe one other orchestra hears about it and maybe picks it up. This is a different ball game.
Because they're really touring and playing the same literature.
And they're doing it because they want to.
Yeah. So you wrote them a piece they love.
Yeah.
Can you tell us anything about it?
Well, it's a piece that's lit from within, which I guess is something that I do with most pieces. But this one is particularly aimed at that. That's why it's called Incandescent. Mm. And it has... It's a longer piece, 17 minutes, and it is very virtuosic. And there are solos for everybody, except the second violin. This, yeah. which are very challenging. It's a much harder piece than the other two, actually.
Of course, the Tokyo is a great quartet too, but knowing that certainly the Emerson is the premier or one of the premier quartets, mm-hmm. did that influence how challenging you made the music?
At some point,
you knew you had no limits.
At some point, you have to go with the music. Mm-hmm. Whether you think virtuosity or not is secondary. You have to go with the music. This piece just turned out to be virtuosic.
And you said, I love the word incandescent, and I was going to ask you if when you start a piece, what do you start with? Do you start with an idea? And would that have been the idea that you might have started with in this piece, that that's what you wanted to achieve in the piece, a sort of inner glow?
I can't remember. Sorry.
When you start, is it possible to describe how the process starts just in terms of, okay, I'm going to write a piece for this, just pick, you know, anything. For this group, it's going to be around 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you take a walk or whatever, you know. Mm-hmm.
You got to be careful where you're going in the walk. I heard a piece of Vaughan Williams the other night called Sea Symphony. Mm-hmm. It's an hour long. I found it so tedious. It just didn't know where it was going, and it just went on. And the conductor said, well, Bernstein had said, you know, the thing about Vaughan Williams is he used to take long walks, and he never knew where he was going. That reminded me of what you just said. I don't take long walks.
You don't take walks. All right, so you're...
I do treadmill. No, I start with a piece, and I sculpt it very organically, and I listen to it very carefully and see what it's trying to be. And that's basically the way I work. Mm-hmm. Very slow process, but it's the one that works for me.
Is it possible to describe how that, you know, the Big Bang, you know, where does the initial germ come from?
I have no idea.
Or what you're trying, but there's that, you just let that happen.
Yeah,
and
I used to think about the first idea. Mm-hmm. First idea is really not that important.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you do with it.
Yeah. Do you plan the whole piece?
No.
Before you write it, or do you go?
I never plan because I don't trust it. I don't trust the planning. Like, oh, theme A is going to come back again. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe it will. You know, I don't trust. See, there's a logic that you can do with pre-planning that is perfectly therapeutic. It's usually therapeutic because it gives you this feeling that you know where you're going.
Yeah.
You know. But the problem is that it may not be very musical. It
may not be where the music's going.
You have to be careful of maps because they're logical and comfortable, but they're not necessarily musical. So I've learned that those kinds of map thinkings are very dangerous, actually, for me.